You and I back together again Thursday, May 12, 2022 on Connecticut Today. I wondered out loud if the big oil companies are maybe guilty of price gouging during the present spike in inflation and the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Southern Connecticut State University poli-sci professor Dr. Jonathan Warden added his perspective this time around on the continuing abortion controversy. Gasoline prices. Nancy Pelosi just came out and made a declaration earlier today, and Let's posit what she said. Let me get your thoughts on this. Now, before we get into the gas prices, the argument here are the gasoline companies, well, are they sticking it to us? Are they giving us that exam that neither men nor women like, if you know what I mean? Average price of gasoline today in the Constitution State of Connecticut, the People's Republic of Connecticut, Chairman Lamont sends his greetings. $4.38 a gallon. $4.38. Okay, $4.37.9. Sorry. Who the hell am I to add another tenth of a cent on there? Come on, Paul. Don't make it worse than it is. AAA, our friends at AAA on the website gasprices.aaa.com. Click on Connecticut, and you see the word $4.38 a gallon. So it's a good thing we got rid of that 25-cent state tax, what, till the end of the calendar year? Because without that, let's see, $4.38, $4.38, $4.58, we'd be at $4.63 a gallon, if not for the gallantry of our fine men and women lawmakers, the gubernator and all his other people up in the great state capital. But we're not at that level, but we still are at prostate exam level here, $4.38 a gallon. In Connecticut, the national average, according to AAA, and there are some other averages out there. The Lundberg Survey does this, GasBuddy.com does their thing with their reporting stations, and I don't anticipate it being a whole lot different either way. But the national average, $4.42 a gallon. Yikes. $4.42 a gallon nationally, $4.38 a gallon in Connecticut. Why do I mention this? What are you doing this for, Paul? It was expensive 2 weeks ago. It was expensive yesterday. It's expensive today, and it's going to be expensive tomorrow. Why do I do this? Well, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, today the number three person in the federal government. You have El Presidente, you have the Vice Presidente, and you have the House Speaker. Nancy Pelosi, the number three person in the federal government, going to town today on the oil companies, according to this story in The Hill. She's accusing the industry of exploiting consumers with sky-high gasoline prices, even as the same companies are reporting record profits this year. She said during a press briefing in the Capitol, she said, quote, "This is a major exploitation of the consumer because this is a product the consumer must have." The leap in the prices at the pump, notes The Hill, is part of a larger inflationary spike affecting a host of consumer goods, and it has dogged President Biden and his Democratic allies on Capitol Hill, who are scrambling for ways to reduce the trend ahead of the November midterms. So, again, the question begs here, are the oil companies being the bad guys here? Are the oil companies being the bad guys here? Or, as some of the experts I've had on the show here have said to you and me who gather around the radio here in the afternoon, what have they said? Well, you know, for a lot of people, it's actually the middle people, the middle men, the middle women, the commodities traders on Wall Street and the oil market. They're the ones to blame. Sponsored by Democratic Reps Kim Schreier of Washington State and Katie Porter of California, there's a proposal that would grant new authority to both the FTC and state attorneys general to scrutinize how fuel prices are set. Now, for the first 3 months of the year, now here's the evidence that Speaker Pelosi is using, and other people are. For the first 3 months of the year, ExxonMobil reported $5.5 billion in profits, more than twice the figure from a year ago. BP, which used to be British Petroleum, do they go by that anymore? I have no idea. BP reporting $6.2 billion in profits for the quarter, up from $2.6 billion in the first 3 months of 2021. Chevron saying it pulled in $6.3 billion versus $1.4 billion over the same time last year. Now, here's the core of the question I have for you, and the core of the argument you're going to hear over the next few days, partly because it may be a sound economic idea to float out there, or partly because they need to change the Democrats need to change the narrative on this because of the poll numbers, and maybe they're a little, you know, skitsy about abortion and all that. Democrats argue that these oil companies can easily afford to pass any extra profits to the consumers instead of their shareholders. They say, particularly amid Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So how about that? Quote, while families are struggling to pay higher prices at the pump, oil and gas companies are recording record profits, with the seven biggest oil companies announcing stock buybacks that could total $41 billion this year alone. So what do you think of this whole thing? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Are the oil companies price gouging here or not? What do you think? And that's our Facebook question of the day, facebook.com/WICC600. Do you think the major oil companies are exploiting consumers and keeping gasoline prices artificially high? Or do you think, as has been explained here on the show before, this is a complicated thing because we've cut down on or have promised to cut down on Russian imports, and the commodities traders get in the way here, or they do what they do, trying to turn profit, seeing what something is at X amount of time, and then buying futures on this? Do you blame the oil companies for this? You know, it's kind of funny. A lot of lawmakers out there saying, well, you know, Putin's price gouging. But then now all of a sudden they're kind of shifting gears here and starting to say, well, maybe it's the gasoline and oil companies. I don't know. Which is nothing new. I mean, we've been debating this over and over and over again. Shed a little common sense thinking here on the program as to what people are looking at with national, local, and state issues here. Of course, one being abortion op-ed from one of our stable of contributors here. Despite the partisan outcry over Roe v. Wade, abortion policy is not a binary argument, and maybe this is a good thing that we're talking about this now, because we've kind of yelled and screamed about it, but logical reason thought on this is few and far between. Dr. Jonathan Wharton joins us, Associate Dean, School of Grad and Professional Studies at Southern Connecticut State University, specializing in politics. John, good to have you back on. How have you been?
Good, doing well. Thanks for having me back on, Paul. I appreciate it.
You know, John, there are times in America, the civil rights stuff in the late 60s, early 70s, Watergate, which I just talked about, Iran-Contra, 9/11, where they might be very tense, very bad things, you know, January 6, 2021. But we need to use those times, and I hate the word teachable moment, John, so I'll go with maybe a reset in thinking, or to look at where we've come since the last time we took a hard look at that and did something on that. And I think, as you point out, this abortion thing, yeah, I mean, this is not binary. It cannot be A or B, and maybe it's good we're finally being forced to reckon with this again.
I think so, but my biggest fear, as you read there, is that I really sense, and I'm certain many people feel the same way, that it's being framed more as a partisan lens issue. And, you know, what's being lost in all of this, and I really kind of, you know, put that more on the politicos, the politicians, you know, the party leaders and the media, instead of looking at it more through a moral, even a religious concern or issue, you know?
And John, I'm glad you brought up that part about the media, because I said one of the things that just galls me here. And before I did this, I was a credential reporter. I did a bunch of street reporting and anchoring and stuff like that. I hate when this business just goes to one side. You know, let's put a mic in front of one side that's going to scream at the other side, and let's then put a mic and a camera in front of the other side screaming back at the first side without looking at the nuances of this, John, and how somebody can be pro-life or pro-choice, but they can have a nuanced, better thinking at that. And unless we highlight that, John, I think we're in deep trouble here.
We are, and I think a part of it is that we're not paying attention in terms of what the other side is having to say. And so that's one of the biggest issues why I wrote the op-ed the way that I did, is that, you know, all the sides have to be there.
Absolutely. John, hang on. We'll be right back with you. Dr. Jonathan
Certainly.
Wharton joining us, Southern Connecticut State University. Are we just caught up in this me bad, you good, me good thing on abortion here? Why don't we look at the nuances here? More on John on that with John first. Traffic and weather together right here on WICC. All right, as the debate shows no sign of abating in the nation over abortion, the op-ed in Connecticut News Junkie, ctnewsjunkie.com. Check it out. Despite the partisan outcry over Roe v. Wade, abortion policy is not a binary argument. Hallelujah, Dr. Jonathan Wharton, Southern Connecticut State University. John, before the break, you said we need to look at more nuances in this, especially when it comes to morals and religion. But I bet you, John, if you said that at some, and maybe you have or maybe you will, at some panel discussion, you're going to get kind of that immediate putback. Well, doctor, professor, with all due respect, morals and religion have no setting in this society because it's separation of church and state. What would you say to that?
I would counter that, you know, we are human beings, right? We're all attached to something beyond just politics. And I think that we do, many of us at least, have an ability to be moral and rational and even religious in many instances. So you can't just subtract one area over another, right? We are human beings. We are nuanced. And you can't just shape things purely through a partisan lens. That's just the nature of politics and just how we even think and operate as rational beings.
Yeah, John, and dovetailing off that, that's kind of what I've always thought. And when I bring into these discussions is, I don't care, John, whether it's immigration, guns, abortion, freedom of speech. So many of us, John, are formed in our politics because of our what we have lived in our lives, the environment, our families, our experience here in America, whether it be these things. And gosh darn it, John, it just to me, we're in a society now where, well, why do you think that way? Well, you don't know my story, don't you? You don't know what I've dealt with gun violence or an abortion. I think that's another thing, John, that we just have to take a deep breath about. It kind of runs into what you just said.
Indeed. And actually, I'm a big fan of studying political socialization. It's kind of a technical term of measuring how people understand or frame political concerns, issues, those kinds of things. And it's really complex and a fascinating dynamic of what makes an individual think and operate the way they do, ideologically, morally, even religiously sometimes. And so I think a lot of that is lost, unfortunately, because of just this, you know, blue-red dynamic that we see too often when it comes to our political understanding of issues.
How do we snap out of that, John? Is that a generational thing? Is it a media thing? How can we start to think critically again on these hot button issues and stop like it's the Yankees and the Red Sox and the Knicks and the Celtics and all that? I mean, can we get away from the uniform thing on this?
Well, I think it's all the above, right? A part of it is that it's important. It's critical that we understand the issues and we do read and listen to media, but we also have to understand, take a step back, that the media can frame things in a certain lens. And so we need to be at least, you know, objective about that. The other thing is that there has to be more communication taking place, no matter who the individuals are. Unfortunately, that a lot of that is lost. And so that's got to be said. And then finally, as you hit on, Paul, there is a generational struggle taking place. I've been stressing that over and over again in my research. It's amazing how pronounced the generational divisions are there internally, but certainly, you know, amongst the various generations and how they communicate or even understand these issues.
Yeah, and John, and by the way, Dr. Jonathan Wharton, one of our contributors, is the guest. We love having him on here on WICC. John, the other thing here, part of this story, separating out the actual what this decision may portend from this Mississippi case is the fact that this was leaked, and from a completely separate the abortion part of it. When I woke up a few mornings ago and I heard this, and I just said, wow, I don't care what the case is, this is not good. What are your thoughts on that?
I can't stop paying attention to this, Paul. You know, if you surveyed, speaking of generations and how we view government, you know, so many Americans, right, they have a distrust, a healthy one, really, of Congress, right? Because generally it's 85 to 90% time and time again for the last 20 years against Congress. And in the White House, we know where those polls generally are. No matter who's been the president for the last 20 years, it usually hovers around 35 to 45% at best. Guess what? The Supreme Court has been much higher than that. In some instances, you know, they're higher than 60%. But now, in terms of what's taking place here, this is really, you know, going to rock the foundation to which the court has rested on. And that is trust between the judges and what is said between them, let alone what's going to be said outside of, you know, before a decision even takes place here.
Speaking of the White House, John, the White House, I guess you may have seen this came out late yesterday. There were reports of the White House telling some of their aides in Congress to then go to some lower level people and try to get these protesters to say, hey, you want to scream and yell and get out the bullhorns in front of the Supreme Court building, that's fine. The visual of protesters at the private homes of these justices, the White House is begging people not to do that. And, John, listen, I'm all for freedom of speech, but that's a dangerous area. At least I think. I could be wrong.
Well, you know, it's one thing when you're doing it on the steps of the Supreme Court. I can understand your concerns as it surrounds, you know, somebody's house, right? Because that's a private, you know, place. But, you know, don't be surprised if we're going to see more of these instances, because it seems to be that we're going in that direction.
Final question, John. Look into your crystal ball. Is this as big of an issue for the midterms as some people may think it is or may want it to be? What do you think?
Well, you know, I believe in what Vincent Hutchings has to say, and he's a professor of political science, and he says this, what you oftentimes need is not a lightning rod issue, but kind of a wake-up call, kind of a reminder. He calls it a sleeping giant principle, where usually it's one cause that will really stir people's passions and emotions, and we got to admit it, that we're seeing this certainly on both sides of the aisle. And so sometimes this is a big wake-up call for people to be engaged in. Sometimes what is a disconnected midterm election, because few people generally show up for congressional races. So you might see a bigger turnout.
We'll see. Great to hear from you, Dr. Jonathan Wharton, Southern Connecticut State University. John, good to talk with you. Take care, and we'll talk down the road.
Thank you.
Be good. Bye-bye. Dr. Jonathan Wharton here, Southern Connecticut State University. Check out his op-ed in the Connecticut News Junkie, ctnewsjunkie.com. Despite the partisan outcry over Roe v. Wade, abortion policy is not a binary argument, and it ain't.